I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to The Connection.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine. An eating machine. A great white shark. A stake to claim in the waters off Amity Island.
You yell barracuda.
Everybody says,
huh?
What?
You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
That's the trailer to Steven Spielberg's 1975 movie Jaws, featuring John Williams' famous score. Audiences flocked to the film to get terrified, myself included. In fact, I remember screaming at the top of my lungs when the shark finally appeared after so many near sightings and so much tension and buildup. Why do we humans want to scare ourselves? We have a lot to choose from besides movies like Jaws. There are TV shows and ghost stories, crime stories, fairy tales, roller coasters, haunted houses, even conspiracy theories. We've asked Colton Scrivener to join us. He's a behavioral scientist at the Recreational Fear Lab at Aarhus University in Denmark and in the psychology department at Arizona State University. He's been researching morbid curiosity. He runs scary film festivals and organizes zombie crawls. He says being frightened can be good for our health, a kind of practice session if something terrifying really happens. Well, we have a lot to talk about. And Colton Scrivener, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with you and let's go back to the beginning. How far back do we have to go to find out when you became interested in scary things, in morbid things?
Well, as a kid, I was interested in sort of scary games, but I certainly never thought I would be studying them as a career. Even into grad school, you know, I started studying the psychology behind our interest in fear and in feeling afraid when I was a first or second year grad student. And actually one of my first studies was at a haunted attraction in Denmark.
Oh, wow. You grew up, I should say, this really almost shocked me. You grew up in a town called Slaughterville, Oklahoma. Do I have that right?
You do. And I never made that connection until, you know, at a different point in time, somebody was asking me about that and where I grew up and I mentioned it to them and they also thought I was joking. And then I realized
you really did grow up there.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
So what scares you today that maybe continues to scare you that maybe, you know, didn't so long ago?
That's a good question. You know, I think one of the things that scares me today is the way our attention is dwindling, it seems. So we have a hard time, you know, paying attention to long form anything. I think that worries me more than anything else.
Did you and do you enjoy the feeling of being scared?
I think it depends, right? You know, I sometimes enjoy it if it's of course in a safe setting, right? Nobody enjoys feeling afraid if they think there are going to be consequences to that feeling or attached to that feeling. I think a lot of people enjoy feeling afraid if they're in a safe setting and they know that in a few moments everything is going to be fine.
It is interesting when you look at how the body responds, or maybe even how the brain responds to excitement and fear. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really almost the very same response, but it can be sort of exciting fun or exciting fearful.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of, you know, if you're experiencing something exciting, your hands might get sweaty, your heart will start racing. You might start to feel a little bit jittery. And the same thing happens when you're feeling afraid. And it doesn't matter if you're feeling afraid because something truly terrible is happening, or you're feeling afraid because you're, you know, watching Jaws for the first time in theaters.
Is there something evolutionarily understandable when it comes to why we want to frighten ourselves?
I think so. You know, I've often tie this back to, you know, kind of how other animals experience fear out in the wild. And so if you look at, let's say, like a zebra or a gazelle, you know, if you're out on the Serengeti and you've got some gazelles out grazing, and a cheetah, you know, maybe walks up, you would expect, and I'm not a gazelle, but if I'm trying to imagine myself as a gazelle, I would think, well, I should run every time that I see a cheetah because a cheetah is my natural predator. But it turns out that the gazelles don't always do that. In fact, some gazelles, and in particular the adolescents and the sub-adults, will spend some time observing the cheetah, some time inspecting them and trying to understand sort of what they're like, both physically and then also behaviorally, how they behave. And so I think that's, those are kind of the evolutionary roots of what I've called morbid curiosity in humans that relates to our fascination with all things, scary and macabre.
In fact, you have talked about I think it was a Darwin study or theory looking at monkeys and snakes. It kind of told the same story with zebras and gazelles.
Yeah, Darwin, I've done a lot of work on morbid curiosity, but obviously I didn't come up with the observation, right? This has been a long, long observed thing. And, Darwin mentioned it in The Descent of Man. He said that he had heard a story from a guy named Brehm who said that some monkeys would come up to this box that had a snake in it, and the monkeys would look inside, see the snake, shriek, and run away, which is a pretty typical alarm call for this type of monkey. And what was interesting is that in most situations, the monkeys would all run away, in the wild. In this particular case, though, other monkeys would come up and they would peek inside the box and they would shriek and run away. And in fact, he was so intrigued by this observation that he ran his own study at the London Zoological Gardens, where he did the same thing with a snake in a bag, and he found the exact same thing. And he called it, he said that the monkeys were satiating their horror in a most human fashion, which
Wow.
I love that line because it really speaks to this fact that you see this in other animals in various kinds of ways, but it's really expressed in all kinds of new ways in humans.
And that would be a kind of definition for morbid curiosity, right?
Yeah, so I've defined it as an interest or curiosity in learning about threats. And those threats could be real, something that's happening on the news, but they are true crime, but they could also be fictional threats, because fictional threats do an excellent job of, taking the aspects of real threats and presenting them to us in a way that our minds interpret them as potential threats. Now, of course, one part of our mind knows that the monster on the screen is not a real monster and that we're watching a movie. But the other part of our mind is still kind of triggered by the big teeth that the shark has and by the hunting that it does. Those things trigger very old neurological circuits that evolved to deal with predators.
Well, and I would think morbid curiosity is sort of a push-pull, right? We're curious, we're interested, we want to know, but we're repulsed or scared because it might involve death or disease or something really scary.
That's right. A push-pull is exactly the way that I kind of think about it, or a cost-benefit, is a way to think about it. And if you look at other animals, oftentimes their only opportunity to learn about potential threats is to observe them firsthand, right? And that comes with a lot of cost. It's costly if you're a gazelle to observe a cheetah. It's important because you need to learn something about your natural predator, but it is costly, and so they don't do it too often. And when you get to humans, what you find is that, of course, we have the capability to create, transmit, and consume stories in all different kinds of media. And so what happens is we can create very, very safe scenarios with not just threats that someone else has experienced, but threats that nobody has ever experienced, right? You can create an all new kind of threat, an all new kind of apocalyptic story that nobody has experienced, but maybe we have some concerns about. And then if you keep that somewhat realistic, it becomes very interesting to us, right? Because it seems to our minds as a rare opportunity to learn about something very important.
But we live in, I think, a less scary world than our ancestors. I mean,
I
most of
would say
us
so.
don't worry about being eaten by a lion. So we create these fantasy worlds in order to what? To make sure that we're on guard for things that might happen that are bad.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with you that pretty much everyone living today is living a better life than anyone was 10,000 years ago. Even people in the most dire of conditions are living almost like kings were, a long time ago. And I think so that you're right to raise the question, well, why would we create these
Right.
fictional scenarios of things that we're probably never going to experience? And the answer is that, we've come a long ways in the last couple hundred years, but our minds are still, very old works in progress. And so there's a lot of layers there that are still operating, in much the same way that our ancestors' minds were operating 5,000, even 50,000 years ago. And so our minds are vigilant, right? And of course, there's variation in that. Some people are more vigilant or less vigilant, but we're always vigilant towards potential threats. And so anytime we are not experiencing them, in some cases, that can actually turn up our vigilance because we are almost expecting to experience them. Our mind has been crafted almost to expect those dangers to come about. And so when we miss them, that's how you get things sometimes like conspiracy theories or paranoia or generalized anxiety or other kinds of feelings associated with something might go wrong, even if there's nothing maybe very tangible or obvious.
I mean, that does raise questions about people living, and there are people living in war zones today.
Of course.
You know, you don't have to practice being afraid because you are terrified probably 24/7. So how do you think does morbid curiosity take on a kind of different meaning in conflict zones?
Well, I think in some ways, yes, right? So I tend to think of it a bit like a kind of like a bell curve. You know, you've got if you've experienced no danger in your life, and there's no reason to believe that you would, you say you live in a very coddled, kind of safe place, you're probably not going to be that morbidly curious because there's not going to be any indication that information about threats is useful. And if you live in a war zone, there's lots of information that there's lots of cues that threats about information is useful, but you're perhaps already getting that information in other kinds of ways. You don't need to simulate it. So it's really those of us who are kind of in the middle, right? Like there's some threats maybe looming on the horizon. We live safe lives, but you know, maybe something could go wrong at some point. Those are the people who are going to be the most morbidly curious in most cases. Now, of course, there's still variation among people on, you know, within populations and all of that. But yeah, it's kind of this potential for a threat that really, really drives our morbid curiosity.
About a minute before our first break here, do you think younger people are more morbidly curious than older people?
Well, not only do I think it empirically seems to be true that
So
adolescents, young adults, interestingly, just like those gazelles, the adolescents and the young adults are the ones who are engaging in the most morbidly curious behaviors.
Because when you get older, I mean, death and disease becomes more real, right?
Well, and you've already kind of learned some stuff. You know, you've had a life behind you where you've already learned some of those things. Maybe you were curious about them when you were younger, you know?
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Colton Scrivener. He's a behavioral scientist at the Recreational Fear Lab. Who knew such a lab existed? And that's at Aarhus University in Denmark. He's also in the psychology department at Arizona State University. And we're talking about morbid curiosity. That's something he's been studying for some time now. He's got a book that'll be coming out next year dealing with that particular issue. We've been talking about what it is about human beings that we like to scare ourselves. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We will be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Is it Captain Howdy? You ever heard of exorcism?
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon? I'm Damien Karras. I'd like to help you. Where's Reagan?
In here with us.
That's from the 1973 film The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin, about a demon that possesses a young girl. And Colton, my palms are sweating in that 30 seconds of listening to that clip.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't take much to kind of trigger those instant fearful reactions.
So what is it about scary movies? And I should say that it's not my thing. I when I see trailers, I generally say to myself, well, that's a movie I'm not going to watch. But what for people that love it, what is it about scary movies that's so entertaining and so fun?
Well, I think, when nature wants to motivate us to do something that's ultimately good for us, like, let's say, learn how to avoid a threat, it has to act on, evolution has to act on more proximate types of things, like feeling enjoyment when we do a particular activity that leads us to engage in behaviors that help us out. And so in the case of scary movies, for example, what those are doing is they're kind of tapping into these proximate mechanisms that we have where we feel curiosity, we feel entertainment, and sometimes we even feel enjoyment when we can safely experience or learn about something that is threatening.
Which makes a lot of sense. And I wonder, I would assume for some people, I don't want to call them adrenaline junkies, but I think for some people it's maybe they are. Maybe that is who they are. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's what we call them in our papers, they're adrenaline junkies. So I guess that's probably okay to call them that. I've done a few studies where we essentially tried to, we asked the question, that you just asked, why are people going to haunted houses or horror movies and what do they get out of that? Why do they do that? And kind of the traditional answer in psychology was for a long time was, well, they do it because some people like the adrenaline rush. And that's the only reason. And when I first started studying this, I obviously came across that small, but pre-existing literature that saying that adrenaline junkies or the adrenaline rush rather is the reason that people enjoy horror movies. And it didn't seem intuitively right to me. And it didn't seem like it made a lot of sense that would be the only reason, right? Because there are actually a lot of ways that you can get an adrenaline rush. Right. And horror movies, maybe even aren't the best way to do it. You can get a bigger adrenaline rush on a roller coaster or skydiving or riding a motorcycle or bungee jumping. I mean, there's so many other ways that you can get a bigger, better adrenaline rush that it would surprise me if the only explanation for the popularity of horror movies was the adrenaline rush. And so, I had some reasons to believe that maybe that wasn't true. And so I ran my own study where I identified three different kinds of horror fans, if you will. And this is not to say this is the only reasons that people like horror movies, but it seems to be that there are at least three sort of common features about them. And one of those is the adrenaline rush. There are some people who enjoy horror pretty much, not exclusively, but mainly for the adrenaline rush that they get. But there's a second group of people who we call the white knucklers. So if you squeeze your fist together and you look at your knuckles, you might see that there's kind of a whitish color that from the blood escaping, from me squeezing. And we gave them that name because in many of our photos in this haunted house, when they would walk through, they would be squeezing their knuckles so tight you could see the white on their knuckles from the video. And these people obviously were very afraid during this haunted house attraction. But when they came out, we asked them about their experience and they said, well, I didn't really enjoy the feeling of being afraid so much, but I did enjoy the feeling of overcoming that fear. Uh-huh. And so they enjoyed the kind of confidence, almost like a confidence boost that you get from proving to yourself that you can get through something difficult. And then we found a third group that we didn't expect to find, actually. We expected the first group, the adrenaline junkies, and we sort of thought we would find the second group, too, because we had some reasons to believe that there were people who enjoyed horror because of the self-confidence boost you can get out of scaring yourself and overcoming it. But then we found a third group that we called them the dark copers. And we called them that because this group seemed to use scary play, if you will, or, playful, scary experiences as a way to deal with difficult or dark emotions that they were experiencing, whether that was depression or anxiety or anger or fear, whatever it was, they seemed, playing with those in a setting that was safe seemed to help them out. And so we called them the dark copers.
Which makes a lot of sense because I'm thinking about the kind of therapeutic treatment for people who have phobias or fears, let's say, fears of going over a bridge or fears of height. Mm-hmm. And you slowly introduce them to this experience and have them sort of learn to master what that feeling is. So what you just described to me makes a lot of sense. And it just seems almost therapeutic.
That's right. And so, an obvious next question that, you know, some of the listeners might be asking as well, you know, under what circumstances are you going to find yourself in an abandoned building with a man with a chainsaw and that you need to overcome that, you know? And that's a fair question, but the answer is that you're probably not. But what you will find yourself in, the situations you will find yourself in, are situations where you are feeling overwhelmed and are feeling afraid, are feeling anxious about what's around the next corner. And so when you were talking about exposure therapy, like with heights or with snakes or spiders, and, you know, it's great. That's great for a very specific kind of fear. Right. But there's another kind of exposure therapy, a related one called interoceptive exposure therapy. And this is really more about exposing yourself to the feeling of feeling afraid, the feeling of feeling anxious, because a lot of people, you know, their maladaptive behaviors come from, not being able to operate like they want to or behave like they want to when they feel afraid or when they feel anxious. And so what horror can do is kind of put you in these safe but very scary situations where you can play with those feelings. You can feel afraid, you can feel anxious, but then you also have the opportunity to kind of regulate that feeling. I mean, one of the most interesting things I think that we've found in our studies at haunted houses is that a lot of people, and this is one of the first studies I did actually at a haunted house, we showed that people weren't trying to experience as much fear as possible. What they were trying to do, or seemed to be trying to do, was experience an optimal amount of fear, kind of a Goldilocks zone of fear. And we had heart rate data to back that up, that people had the most fun when their heart rate variability was kind of high, but not too high. And there was kind of a curvilinear or bell curve shape there. And also the self-reports and their screams. We had videos of their screams. And all of these things kind of triangulated at this fact that people are actively regulating how afraid they feel and how anxious they feel. You do this when you go to the movies and you cover your eyes during the scary scenes, or you plug your ears during the loud scenes, or you grab someone next to you during the jump scares. All of those are coping mechanisms that allow you to regulate those levels of fear and anxiety. And so what that is just practice with regulation, right? Practice with emotion regulation.
It's so interesting because I think free form anxiety that doesn't feel attached to something, is such a debilitating, terrible feeling. I mean, people take medication so that they don't feel anxious. And yet when we go to a haunted house, we're sort of doing that to ourselves, I guess, in a way that feels safe, and we feel sort of in control because we know we can walk out the other side.
Well, and also, you know, the anxiety or run out the other side. Yeah. The anxiety you feel when you're at a haunted house, though, is not generalized, right? I think that's one of the reasons it's helpful. So, you know, I've put forth this model that that may explain why one curious observation that we've found is that people who are anxious tend to really like horror films, which is kind of the opposite of what you might expect at first. And so, you know, I was very interested in that finding, and it kept showing up. And I think what's going on there, one potential explanation is that when you're experiencing generalized anxiety, kind of what you just talked about, where it's not really tethered to any specific thing, but you're feeling, you know, kind of vigilant and you feel like something is wrong, but you can't pinpoint it. That's a really dangerous feeling because it can lead to these vicious cycles of just rumination where it gets worse and worse and worse. And I think what horror offers people like that is it offers them something tangible to feel anxious about. So, you know, if you feel anxiety, if you perceive that there's something potentially dangerous out there, that has such a premium on your attention that it's really hard to knock it, right? It's really hard to just sit back and meditate or watch a cozy movie because the anxiety will almost always have the upper hand. It will always have the premium on your attention. So in some ways you're fighting fire with fire. You're giving your mind something else scary, but tangible, but also safe for it to attach to. And then after 90 minutes, let's say in a horror movie, that threat goes away and your body can kind of engage in its natural cycles of relaxation. So your sympathetic nervous system that heightens all of your fight or flight responses will start to calm down, and your parasympathetic nervous system, which is sort of the rest and relaxation side of your nervous system, it starts to activate and it sort of naturally calms you down. And you hear this from horror fans. You hear people say that they'll put on a scary movie and go to bed, or they'll, you know, feel relaxed after watching a true crime episode. And that kind of makes sense in light of that.
Yeah, because it's sort of having pretend live something so that you can have a good night's sleep. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Colton Scrivener. He's a behavioral scientist at the Recreational Fear Lab at Aarhus University. That's in Denmark. He's also in the psychology department at Arizona State University, and he has been studying morbid curiosity and why we like to scare things, why we like to be scared, and perhaps even why we like to scare other people. Well, let me ask you, are there people that enjoy being scared but don't like scaring other people? I mean, can the world be divided into the scarers and the scaries?
The scarers and the scared.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, I think there are plenty of people who enjoy a good scare but don't necessarily enjoy giving it. And probably, I would imagine, a little bit vice versa, right? I actually haven't done much research on the scarers because it's kind of a different phenomenon. Yeah, it's kind of a different phenomenon, right, if you're the one doing the scaring. And I think that it's such an interesting one that I want to be able to devote quite a bit of time to it, because I think it's a different explanation than morbid curiosity. I don't know that morbid curiosity necessarily plays a role in that aspect of things.
Well, speaking about scary, let's talk a bit about fairy tales. And I remember when when our son was a toddler and I started reading some of these stories to him, and I had forgotten how scary they are, about wolves and witches and wicked stepmothers, mm-hmm. and, you know, again, you know, and then go to sleep, dear, and we'll see you in the morning. but fairy tales and children, I mean, children then love these stories. Is it just this sort of primitive desire, the things that we have been talking about, but just on a more developmentally primitive level?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I mean, kids are very morbidly curious. You know, one of the studies that my colleagues over in Denmark did was they went to I believe it was a preschool or a kindergarten or sort of their equivalent of that. Anyways, the young children in school, and they were asking the teachers about how their kids felt about scary play and scary stories. And they said, well, the kids love it. And in fact, we tell them scary stories and we scare them. And they had these great videos of these little kids sitting around listening to a scary story from their teacher. And it was interesting because these Danish teachers weren't scientists per se. They hadn't read our work, but they had this intuition that giving kids a chance to hear these scary things and be okay with that and learn how to overcome that fear was good for them. And that's exactly what our research was showing. So it was really interesting to see this kind of in practice, you know, from an entirely different angle.
Well, that's like Bruno Bettelheim and the uses of enchantment. I mean, that's really what he was exploring as well, perhaps without all the baggage, but that's what he was exploring as well.
Well, and there's a great Neil Gaiman quote. I don't want to misquote him, but it's something along the lines of, you know, the great thing about fairy tales is not that they have dragons, but that they show us how we can slay dragons, right? It's not about it showing, giving us fear, but showing us how to overcome fear.
It's interesting to think about fairy tales and dangerous play. I know that's something else that you look at, and whether, you know, I don't want to make a global statement here, but whether we've, you know, made childhood too safe for, you know, middle-class kids growing up in a first world country. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it dovetails with, you know, what we've been talking about, which is if you don't give kids the opportunity to do things that feel scary, they're going to be ill-equipped to deal with those feelings when they inevitably run into them, you know, in adolescence or in adulthood. And, you know, Peter Gray is a psychologist. He talks a lot about this and kind of the rise in anxiety diagnosis as what he called unstructured play or unsupervised play has declined. And so basically giving kids the autonomy to do some scary things and prove to themselves that they can get over it. You know, this is very important for their emotion regulation development.
I remember doing an interview about, you know, playgrounds where they instituted, you know, where kids could set things on fire and have pointed sticks and all of that. I mean, I don't know if that's going too far, but it's, you know, it's not like the very safe playgrounds that we have today.
Yeah, but I assume they had the right, you know, the right reasoning for why they were doing that.
Yes, they did.
I'm not familiar with that particular one, but I assume it's, yeah, to give the kids some independence and give them something, you know, with some supervision, with some guards in place, but to give them something that's a little dangerous, right? Because then they have to learn how to handle this dangerous situation. And there's a lot of value in that. There's a lot of teaching value that you can't get from a book or you can't get from a story, you know, that it's firsthand.
And do you think scary stories, not just for children, but for all of us, I mean, that it does tap into some of our darker impulses, whether, you know, whether we're going to be a serial killer or not. We do have anger, we have rage, we have, you know, feelings of resentment and a lot of negative things that can be swirling around in our emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I haven't looked into that as much, but for sure, you know, we have sometimes it can be relieving, I think, to see this play out in an almost fictional way that we would never act on, or we would never, you know, but it can be probably relieving for some people to see that play out if you're having a rough day. Because, and it's important to note that that's because, you know that right. There are no consequences to what's happening on the screen, right? You know that that's not a real thing. You're not going to go and watch a newscast about a war. You're going to go and watch a fictional story about something that's not real. I think that's an important distinction that sometimes gets lost in those discussions.
What do you make about the popularity of crime or true crime stories? And it seems like between podcasts and TVs and shows, there's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's an old impulse too, though. You know, there's Richard Wrangham. He's a primatologist, evolutionary anthropologist at Harvard, and he's written a book and has a lot of great ideas about kind of this shift in aggression in humans. So most animals are what you would call reactively aggressive. So if you make a dog angry or a wolf angry, it's going to bite you, right? It's going to react right away in an aggressive way. And many animals are like that, not just to other species, but importantly, like to their own species, right? If you're the alpha chimp and another chimp comes up and tries to take your food, you're going to immediately attack them or bite them, right? You have reactive aggression. And humans had that for a long time too. But what's interesting is, you know, if you look at humans today, we actually have what's called proactive aggression. And you can think about it kind of like, you know, here in the US, first degree murder versus second degree murder, sort of premeditated, planned versus non-planned. And that planned murder, that proactive aggression, is something that is somewhat unique to humans. Certainly the extent to which we do it is unique. And what's interesting about that is that kind of this hidden aggression, right? If you're being proactively aggressive, if I plan or plot to hurt someone, I'm intentionally hiding what I want to do. And that makes it really difficult for that person to find out what I want to do to them. And so there had to be this selection pressure at some point, this evolutionary selection pressure to be curious about people who are potentially dangerous, because reactively aggressive people are easy to spot. They have a short temper. They're brash. They might yell a lot. You know, you can kind of probably envision people like this that are reactively aggressive. But it's much harder to envision someone who's proactively aggressive, because they are intentionally, by definition, hiding their aggression. And so what you have to do is learn to kind of spot them or be curious about the kinds of people who you know, who've been caught, the serial killers that have been caught, you know, learning about their profiles and their backgrounds. And that's why true crime focuses so much on serial killers' backgrounds and their childhoods and their lives. It's not because they're glamorizing them. It's because that's the kind of information that at least seems important in understanding why this person did what they did and how they became who they are.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Colton Scrivener. Again, he's a behavioral scientist and he has been studying something called morbid curiosity. We're talking about why we like to scare ourselves and what we learn from putting ourselves into scary situations. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
That, of course, is the trailer from Wes Craven's 1984 supernatural slasher film, Nightmare on Elm Street. And again, we are talking about why we like to scare ourselves, and something that our guest has been studying for some time now. His name is Colton Scrivener, and he has been looking at morbid curiosity. We played two clips, and obviously we're on the radio here, so there are no visuals, but it got me thinking about how sound, and of course music, but especially how sound can really amplify feelings of being afraid.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that actually. So I help organize a conference that's actually taking place today and yesterday called the Zombie Apocalypse Medicine Meeting. And it's a very fun conference where we come together to talk about kind of spooky things as academics. And the keynote yesterday was actually on the sound of fear, coincidentally. And it was very interesting because there's a lot of interesting stuff about horror movie soundtracks that probably play into why they're so effective. So for example, if you listen to a human scream and you kind of look at the acoustics of a human scream, it's very rough, as what people who study that would call rough acoustics. And if you look at the soundtracks of different genres, kind of the music or the scores of different genres, what you find is that the horror genres music actually most closely mimics the human scream. And so, you know, of course, screams, you know, we, like many animals, have these alarm calls that have evolved to warn others when there's danger. And in humans, scream is a pretty clear alarm call that something is wrong. And so what you get in horror movies is music that acoustically mimics that and probably, you know, activates these alarm centers in people who are watching, these kind of vigilance mechanisms in the mind, and prepares us, makes us feel suspense, right? It kind of leads up to those big reveal moments or the jump scares.
Well, and there's been some fantastic music that's been composed for scary films. We're going to close with the music from Psycho, which is, of course, composed by Bernard Herrmann. But, you know, that's sort of classic scary music that has really survived since the since 1960.
Yeah, I think, you know, they figured it out a long time ago, what works and what doesn't. And, you know, they keep trying to come up with new stuff, but sometimes just the, you know, the original stuff that you've discovered sometimes is the best.
I took your morbid curiosity test. People can go to ColtonScrivener.com/morbid curiosity test just to find out how, I guess, what morbidly curious I am. I'm a little below average, but I'm above average when it comes to the minds of dangerous people. And let me just read a couple of questions here. People are asked to either strongly disagree, all the gradations in between that, and strongly agree. And here are some of the issues raised. If I lived in medieval Europe, I would be interested in attending a public execution. I'm curious about crime, enjoy reading detailed news accounts about murders and other violent crimes. I think the supernatural is an interesting topic. I would be interested in watching a documentary on motives behind real murders. I find the occult interesting. There are 24 questions, and that's kind of a smattering of them. What are you looking to understand?
Well, when I first started studying morbid curiosity, you know, I'm interested in behaviors, right? But behaviors are hard to measure all the time. And so what a lot of people who study human behavior do is they'll create a questionnaire, a survey, a scale, something that they can use to quickly assess lots of people so that you can get a large sample size. And so I started studying morbid curiosity. And one of the first things I did, of course, was look for a scale so that I could do some studies on this. And it turns out there really wasn't one, at least not one that had been validated and you know, had been used by others. And so my first task, I guess, was to build this scale. And it was, so I was trying to essentially capture somebody's tendency to engage in morbidly curious behaviors in these, based on their score on these questions. And so I you know, crafted the scale, and it took a long time to kind of get the right questions. And you go through, you know, hundreds of questions to get the right ones and test them in various ways. And then what you do is you test it against some behaviors that are, you would consider morbidly curious. And you see, do scores on this actually map onto people's behaviors? And in this case, for the morbid curiosity scale, it's a very, very strong correlation with morbidly curious behaviors, which would suggest that it taps into that construct pretty well.
And it's about body violation, it's about violence, motives of dangerous people, and paranormal danger. Those are the four basic categories. And I will say, you know, I was most interested, I was above average on minds of dangerous people, not so much on bodily injury. I mean, that's just not something that connects or resonates with me, I have to say.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you know, all four of those load onto the larger morbid curiosity factor, but of course people can vary in each one. And you know, so you have minds of dangerous people that kind of taps into, for example, interest in true crime. So if you score high in that, you probably enjoy true crime or enjoy stories about potentially dangerous people. You have the supernatural or paranormal subscale that kind of taps into dangers that we can't quite see, right? Whether it's a ghost or an alien or a demon or something that's kind of powerful, but a little bit behind the curtain. And then you have violence, which is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's an interest in witnessing acts of violence, and not because you like seeing people hurt, but because you're interested in kind of what that is like, what that experience is like. You know, it's what 80,000 Romans would do when they went to the Colosseum. They were kind of engaging in that morbid curiosity, that subscale of violence. And then, of course, you have the body violation, the one that you mentioned. You're not very high end.
No.
That one, I think on average, people are lower in that. And the reason for that is that we also have a pretty powerful anti-disgust mechanism in our mind. And it adds an additional motivational push away. You know, we talked about that push and pull at the very beginning of the conversation of morbid curiosity. And the body violation one kind of throws in an additional factor there of disgust that pushes us away just a little more. But it's an important one. You know, if your surgeon had no body violation curiosity, he or she probably wouldn't be a very good surgeon. They need to have some curiosity about bodies and injuries and how that works, or at least not be so repulsed by it that they can't become curious about it.
Is there a connection between morbid curiosity and empathy?
People thought so for a long time, and I actually understand the intuition there. You know, if you're not a horror fan and you're looking at all these horror fans going out right now, Terrifier 3 is the top movie in America, right? And it's probably one of the most gruesome horror movies that's ever been made, at least in recent time. And, you know, if you're not a fan of horror movies, you might look at that and think there's no way that these people are empathic or empathetic. You know, there's just no way. And I understand that. But when you look at the science, what you see is that actually people who enjoy horror movies, even the really bloody violent ones, have just as much empathy as anyone else. And in fact, in some of my studies, they actually score a bit higher in what's called cognitive empathy or perspective taking. They're a bit better at actually taking the perspective of other people.
That's fascinating. You did some studies too, looking at the pandemic and I guess what people mm-hmm. did when they were forced to live at home. I guess they watched a lot of movies, a lot of TV. What did you come up with?
Well, you know, obviously the pandemic kind of threw a wrench in everyone's work, if not just scientists, but especially scientists, if you're trying to recruit people and, you know, stand close to them and collect data from them. It's not, the pandemic's not a great, great for that. In my case, you know, I was interested in how people navigated dangerous situations. And so for me, it was kind of a big natural experiment. It was it offered me the opportunity to study how people navigated something that was scary and new to them. And what we were interested in was, you know, kind of what we talked about earlier in this conversation about, you know, if you engage in scary play, does it make you a bit more resilient when real things go wrong? So basically, if you practice with those feelings of anxiety and fear in playful ways, are you better able to manage them when something bad happens? And so what we found was that people who were horror movie fans or people who scored high in morbid curiosity, they were more psychologically resilient in those early months of the pandemic between about April and May.
That's fascinating. I'm thinking of the movie Contagion, which of course predated the pandemic, but you know, and what happened when the one of the characters sneezes and just, you know, there goes whatever out into the universe.
Well, what's super interesting about Contagion, of course, and probably you're familiar with this, but, you know, it came out in 2011 and it, you know, received some acclaim. It was a decently popular movie, but it certainly wasn't like a blockbuster, I wouldn't say. And then it kind of fell into obscurity for several years. And then in March of 2020, it became the most watched movie in the world. Wow. You know, and it was only on one streaming service. You know, imagine if it was on, it wasn't even on like Netflix or anything. And so that kind of raises a curious question. You know, when people are experiencing this you know, pandemic and lockdowns and uncertainty, and so of course they're going to go and engage in escapism. But it's funny that a lot of them engaged in escapism. They escaped into a world that was experiencing the same thing that the real world was experiencing, right? And so the explanation for that, is probably that, you know, they wanted to simulate that and see what happens, because nobody had really experienced a pandemic of that scale in their lifetime. And so the only close simulation of that we had was the movie Contagion.
Humans are just endlessly interesting, aren't we? It just keeps going.
I think so.
Yeah, exactly. That'll keep you busy for a while. You know, I was thinking about doom scrolling, about how easy it is to get pulled, especially, you know, online, going through the internet and getting sort of deeper and deeper into these darker and darker worlds. How do you see that? How do you understand that? And I find myself doing it and not liking that I'm doing it.
Yeah. I think, you know, doom scrolling isn't always about bad news, but a lot of times it can be, right? A lot of times doom scrolling happens when it's just bad news or threat after threat on your timeline. And, you know, the algorithms pick up on that. Humans are intrinsically drawn to information about threats. And so when they're presented with them on an algorithmic social media site, algorithm-based social media site, the algorithm is going to pick up that people are spending more time looking at those or reading those or clicking on those or sharing those or liking them or angry reacting them, you know, not just liking them. Sometimes they're showing that they dislike them, but in any case, they're engaging with them. And that's what, in many cases, what many algorithms optimize for is engagement. And so it's kind of hijacking morbid curiosity almost in a bad way in this case.
You know, I was thinking maybe this is pretty obvious, but when there is a highway accident, I mean, people slow down because the traffic gets slowed down, yeah. But we look, you know, we look even if we don't want to see what we see.
I think many times we don't want to see what we want, you know, what we probably are going to see. And we're not looking so that we can, because we want to see someone injured, but it's more like if someone is injured, I want to make sure that I catch it. You know, like it's more of a rare opportunity to observe something, the consequences of something dangerous, right? I mean, if you boil it down to it, that's essentially what a car wreck on the side of the road is a somewhat rare opportunity to observe the consequences of danger.
Right. And since most of us drive a car, you know, we have a...
It certainly is relevant.
Yeah, it has. There's a message there, you know, one way or the other. I was thinking, too, about in times of change and uncertainty and even... chaos, not necessarily wars and conflicts, but just difficult times. Are we more or less drawn to scary things? I mean, I guess it depends on what we get out of them.
Yeah, you're right. It does kind of depend. And it depends how close to home it is and how personally affected we are and kind of what else we have going on in our lives. But, you know, I think COVID in April, March and April of 2020 is the closest thing we have to a study on that, where, you know, we had this scary pandemic and lockdowns that were happening that nobody had experienced or before, really. And what happened? Well, in a decade-old movie, a scientifically accurate movie about a pandemic, quickly became the most popular movie in America. So I think, you know, we do see that to some extent. It would be super interesting to look, you know, at a larger time scale and see, okay, in times of war or in times of, you know, other kinds of turmoil that have happened in the U.S. or elsewhere, what movies become popular. And I don't know if that data is readily available. It'll become more available as time goes on now because everything is on the internet now, right? But I don't know if data from that, about that would be very available from, let's say, the 60s or the 50s.
Is there a connection between gender or even sexual identity and gender and being morbidly curious? As you were saying, it sort of dissipates as one gets older, but what about gender?
Yeah, I mean, it does dissipate as you get older, though there are, the effect is not super strong. You just have, you know, on average, lower levels of morbid curiosity as you age. But when it comes to, you know, let's say like males versus females, there doesn't seem to be that big of a difference. Sometimes in some of the subscales, you'll find women are a bit higher on minds of dangerous people. Men are sometimes a bit higher on violence. And I think some of that boils down to maybe other factors. You know, there are quite a few studies showing that on average, women are more interested in understanding people than men. Obviously, that's not true for everyone. I'm a psychologist. I'm very interested in people and understanding people. But, you know, if you take a population of 100 women and 100 men, on average, the 100 women will probably show a little bit more interest in understanding people. And so then if you combine that with, you know, understanding dangerous people, you're going to see a small effect of, you know, at large scales. And then with violence, I mean, you know, there are a couple of reasons a couple of things that may explain why men are a bit higher on the violence subscale. It could have to do with, you know, there's some interesting evolutionary speculations about, you know, men are historically more likely to be the ones that have to go to war or that are engaged in violent conflict, and it's a bit more relevant to them, or has been at least for, you know, thousands and thousands of years.
Well, it's been such a pleasure, Colton Scrivener. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times to talk about, on The Connection, to talk about being morbidly curious. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was a very fascinating conversation.
Yeah, for us as well. And again, Colton Scrivener, behavioral scientist at the Recreational Fear Lab at Aarhus University in Denmark and in the psychology department at Arizona State University. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. That is the name of the show that airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for more information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. And yes, that's the music from Alfred Hitchcock's classic horror film, Psycho, composed by Bernard Herrmann. Debbie Bilder produces The Connection, along with Paige Murray Bessler, our engineer today, Joyce Lieberman. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, thanks so much for joining us.